From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. William James wrote in 1892, "All our life so far as it has definite form is but a mass of habits." One bit of research suggests that 40% of the actions we perform each day aren't actual decisions, but habits. So are habits really that important to our life? Award-winning New York Times investigative reporter Charles Duhigg digs into this. You may have read the excerpts of his book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, the excerpt about how Procter & Gamble tapped into habits to make Febreze a successful product, or how Target has tried to figure out when women get pregnant because their buying habits change so drastically. Charles Duhigg, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's just start at the basics. What is a habit?
A habit is a decision that you make at some point and then stop making but continue acting on. So, for instance, the first time you backed your car out of your driveway, it took a major dose of concentration. In fact, probably the first couple of times. But when you do it now, you just kind of do it automatically without really thinking. That's a habit.
And there's a whole process to it. It's not just one thing, right? It's a cue, a routine, and a reward.
That's exactly right. What we've learned in the last decade is from neurology laboratories, our understanding of habits have been completely transformed, particularly how habits can be created or can be changed. And as you pointed out, at the core of every single habit, be it a habit within a person's life or within an organization, there's this basic structure that's called the habit loop, which is a cue, a sort of a trigger for the automatic behavior to start, a routine, which is the behavior itself, and then a reward. And when most people think about habits, they focus on the routine, the behavior. But what we've learned is that this cue and this reward are really the secret to understanding how habits function and to changing them.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Charles Duhigg, the award-winning New York Times investigative reporter. His new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. I've had a really good time reading your book, Charles. It made me think about a lot of different things. You know, you think about a habit as not necessarily being so powerful, but they are. Why is that?
They're powerful because your brain essentially turns off when you're in the middle of a habit, right? There was a study that was done by Duke University a couple of years ago where they followed people around and discovered that about 45% of what feel like choices we make every day are actually just habits. And what's interesting is that when we look at a person's brain when they're in the midst of a habit, they've essentially stopped thinking. Our brain kind of shuts off when a habit begins unfolding. And this is great from an evolutionary perspective, right? Because it means we don't have to think about how to walk every time we're on the sidewalk,
sure,
or what to eat every time we sit down. It gives us sort of the mental energy to invent spears and fire and video games and aircraft carriers. But the drawback of that is that when you're in the grip of a habit, because you're not thinking, you can just do things automatically, even if common sense tells you you should do otherwise.
Do habits trump free will? Are we doing things unconsciously when we're just following a habit, and where can that lead us?
Well, a habit isn't destiny, right? I mean, this is one of the most important things that we've learned, is that as we've learned more about the neurology of habit formation, and we've learned how to create habits and how to change them more easily, we've learned that anyone can take control over their habits. And so just because you have a bad habit, that doesn't mean you're condemned to it. But it does mean that if you want to change that habit, you have to deliberately intervene. You have to make a decision to form a new behavior. And once you do, it'll eventually become automatic and effortless.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories that you use in The Power of Habit to illustrate this. So you got interested in this when you were covering the Iraq War. You saw how an officer, a U.S. officer, used habit modification in a powerful way. What was that?
So I went down to this town named Kufa, which is about an hour south of Baghdad, and talked to this army major. And he had gone to the mayor of Kufa and had asked the mayor to remove all of the food vendors from the plazas. His job was to stop the riots. And so a couple of weeks later, a crowd starts developing. It looks like a riot is about to break out. And it gets to about 5:30, and the spectators suddenly start getting hungry. And so they look around for the kebab sellers that are usually there, but there's no one there. So they go home to have dinner. And then the people one ring in see that some of the outer rings are leaving, so they go home too. And the riot never happened. And in fact, the major had been there 9 months, and there hadn't been one riot since he had gotten there. And so I asked him, like, how did you know that this would happen, that just removing the food vendors would stop the riots? And he told me that the U.S. military is essentially this giant habit experiment, and that everything he learned in the military was about how to create new habits or how to change his own habits, how to communicate habitually with his wife and manage his money without thinking about it, and that once you see the world that way, you sort of get this new toolbox that you can use to begin changing things.
That's such an interesting story. So was part of the reason people were gathering to go to the food carts? I mean, they weren't necessarily there to cause trouble?
I think people were gathering because a crowd just kind of grows on its own, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that we know that's interesting about riots is that they don't happen spontaneously. They take hours and hours to develop, and that's because there's a core group of troublemakers, and then spectators show up to watch them, and then spectators show up to watch the spectators. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually it reaches this tipping point, and then violence breaks out, and everyone goes crazy. And if you can interrupt that pattern, you can stop the riot.
You use Seattle-based Starbucks as an example of a business that's really tapped into changing habits to improve employees' work. How do they do it there?
So Starbucks is this fascinating example because they basically had this core problem, which is they know that customer service is essential. Nobody's going to pay $4 for a latte unless it's delivered with a smile. But Starbucks hires a lot of recent high school graduates. In fact, at one point, Starbucks was hiring 1,700 people a day. And a lot of those people didn't have a lot of life skills. They would get to the end of an 8-hour shift, and they'd be tired and cranky, and some customer would yell, and they would yell back. So Starbucks needed to figure out, how do we give these people habits, willpower habits, so that even after working 8 hours, they can continue smiling? And what they figured out was that they could create these organizational routines that told employees what to do when their individual willpower would kind of get weak. One of my favorites is this thing called the latte method, which was if a customer comes up and is yelling at you or screaming, you're supposed to listen, acknowledge their complaint, thank them, take action to solve it, and then explain why it happened in the first place. For someone who's 17 or 18 and this is their first job, being able to think to themselves, use the latte method when there's a screaming customer in front of you,
sure,
that's incredibly important.
Well,
and that's essentially an organizational habit.
Well, the cue being someone's yelling at you, and maybe without this sort of training, they might go directly to yelling back at them. But the cue puts into place a routine that they've been drilled on. When this cue takes place, someone's yelling at you, you go through this to get to the real goal, which is the satisfied customer.
Exactly. In that sense of like having solved the problem, right? I mean, one of the interesting things about rewards from a neurological perspective is that they're very subtle. So, for instance, when someone backs their car out of the driveway, to use that as an example again, we know from neurological studies that when they finally get into the street, there's this momentary burst of pleasure, this sense of satisfaction that they feel that they might not even be aware of, but that's enough of a reward to create a habit.
Charles Duhigg is with me, and he's written one of my favorite books from recently called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Maybe some of this is resonating with you. Maybe you've worked at Starbucks and gone through ways that they have tried to ingrain habits in you or in other workplaces. Or maybe you've been working on your own habits, good or bad. We're at 206-543-5869. Charles has studied the science of habits. It's 206-543-KUOW, toll-free 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@KUOW.org. Another example you use is about the importance of habit. It has to do with one of the biggest hit songs of 2003 by the hip-hop group OutKast. So record companies and radio stations don't just throw music out there. They test it. They test it extensively. And all their tests of Hey Ya by OutKast was that it was going to become a huge hit. But what happened when radio stations actually started to play it, Charles?
It was a total flop. I mean, it's a great song, right? I love that song.
I love that song, too.
And the first time they put it on the radio, people hated it. In fact, Arbitron was doing this study where they could tell when people would change the station, and a quarter of all listeners in Philadelphia would change the station within the first 30 seconds of Hey Ya coming on the radio.
Now, why did they like it maybe in a controlled situation, or why were they sure it was going to be a hit? Why did they not like it when they heard it on the radio?
The reason why listeners didn't like it is because it sounded so different, right? It sounds like this like kind of new type of music. And one of the things that we know about listening habits in particular, particularly when people are listening to the radio in the car, is we are drawn neurologically to sounds that seem familiar. So this actually explains, if you poll people about Celine Dion, everyone, particularly men, will tell you that they hate Celine Dion. They hate her songs. But if you put a Celine Dion song on the radio, no one will change the station. And that's because her songs, even her brand new songs, they sound familiar. They sound just like all her other songs. It sounds comfortable. And neurologically, we're programmed to like things that key into our listening habits.
So how did they get around the hey ya dilemma?
It's kind of fascinating. What they did is they first of all started looking for songs that were particularly what's called sticky, which means that no one ever changes the station when it comes on. Celine Dion's a great example. Or songs by a group named Maroon 5 or Christina Aguilera. Basically, when those songs come on, because they sound so familiar, even if you've never heard them before, our listening habits are such that we don't change the station. So they found a whole bunch of those songs, and then they started sandwiching Hey Ya between two very sticky songs. So you would hear something from Maroon 5, and then Hey Ya, and then Christina Aguilera. And they did that enough that people essentially just kind of stopped paying attention to Hey Ya. They continued listening because they were used to listening. And over time, they heard Hey Ya enough that it became a listening habit in and of itself. And then the song became a huge hit. It went through the roof.
So, like, they were lulled into it by the Maroon 5 song, which they found utterly unobjectionable, and that kind of carried them through the first 30 seconds of Hey Ya that may have otherwise forced them to tune out?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. And companies do the same thing with all types of products, which you might not notice. But take, for instance, we had an excerpt of the book in the New York Times Magazine that talked about how Target was studying shopping habits to figure out which customers were pregnant. So once they figured out who was pregnant, they would send them all these pregnancy ads, coupons for diapers and lotions, things like that. And when women got those flyers in the mail, they freaked out. They didn't go into Target because they said it was really spooky that Target knew they were pregnant when they had never told the chain.
Uh-huh.
Until Target made one shift. They started putting all of the diaper coupons next to coupons for lawnmowers and wine glasses, the types of things that pregnant women would never buy. And then everyone who got those coupon booklets or those advertisements in the mail, they figured they were just random. And that it was so lucky that they had included some coupons for diapers just by chance. And everyone ended up using them.
I want to go back to the music example for a moment, Charles, because I know there are some of our listeners going, well, that's not true. I don't like familiar stuff on the radio. I want to hear the new stuff. I want to hear the interesting stuff. That's not me. Are you talking about everyone or just most people who listen to a lot of radio?
Well, I think so. There are definitely some aesthetes out there who love to listen to new songs, right?
Yeah.
But here's what I would challenge even those people. When you're in the car and you're only half listening to the radio and only a little bit paying attention, try and figure out the next time that you change the station or that you don't change the station. In fact, next time you're midway through your commute, notice which song is playing and ask yourself, do you really like that song? Or are you listening out of a corner of your brain because it just sounds like what you've grown accustomed to hearing in the car? Some people pay lots of attention to what's on the radio and the songs they're listening to. But most of us, we start kind of thinking about other stuff while we're listening in the car. And as long as the song sounds familiar, as long as it sounds comfortable, we'll continue listening.
Charles Duhigg is my guest. We're talking about the power of habit, how it affects individuals, how it affects businesses and organizations, and how it affects society. Well, I have to admit, Charles, that it really resonated with me. One of the things that I do when I get up before I'm fully awake is go up and exercise. And after the exercise, I know I can come downstairs and drink some coffee, and I'm going to get that kind of satisfaction. And I realized that fits right into your pattern of a habit. It's something that the cue is I've woken up and my feet have hit the floor. The routine is riding on the bicycle. The reward is that great cup of coffee I know I'm going to get at the end.
And it's fantastic, right? I mean, does it feel like you have to make yourself do that, or does
No.
it just happen automatically?
No, I would never exercise if I had to make myself do it.
I mean, it's amazing how our brains can take almost any pattern and make it feel effortless. And in fact, from an evolutionary perspective, this is really, really important, not only because it frees up this mental space, but it means that we can have, for instance, smaller heads. And having a smaller head means that fewer women will die during childbirth. The creation of the neurology around habit formation is critical in why why mammals became as successful a species as we are. But it's also kind of dangerous, right? Because it means whenever you see a donut box on the counter at work, you suddenly start craving a donut, even if you weren't hungry 5 minutes earlier.
New York Times award-winning science reporter Charles Duhigg is with us. We're talking about habits. If any of this resonates with you or if you've got some questions about it, give us a call, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW, toll-free 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@KUOW.org. Now, there are habits, and there are what are called keystone habits. What are they?
So one of the things that scientists have figured out is that some habits matter more than others. That there's some habits that, for instance, if we start changing them, it starts a chain reaction in our lives or in a company that all of a sudden makes other patterns much more malleable. And a great example of this is exercise, because exercise is a keystone habit for a lot of individuals, including maybe you. We found that when people start exercising, that they start eating better, right? Their diet, their eating habits change. And that makes sense, because you start feeling good about yourself, you want to eat better. But also people who start an exercise habit, they start using their credit card less frequently. They start doing their dishes earlier in the day. They procrastinate less at work. And that makes less sense, because what on earth does exercise have to do with your spending habits? But what scientists have figured out and researchers is that when people start exercising, it's a keystone habit. It changes all these other patterns, perhaps in ways that people don't even understand or realize at the time. And so as a result, keystone habits are really important, because it says if you can figure out the keystone habits in your life or in your organization, all you need to do is focus on those, and everything else will change on its own.
Charles Duhigg is my guest. Did you take your 1234 photo? I did. It's the picture we ask you to take at 1234 each day, wherever you are. Post it to our Facebook page, KUOW is the Conversation. Email it to us, conversation@KUOW.org. Tweet it with the hashtag KUOW1234. And once again today, we have a reward. If you send in the 1234 picture we like the best, Lord, save us from your followers. You might remember my interview with Dan Merchant from a couple of weeks ago. He did a video about why is the gospel of love dividing America. He is himself an evangelical Christian. You could get that if we choose your 1234 photo as the very best one today. We're going to take a short break, and when we continue, we're going to be hearing more of our conversation with Charles Duhigg about the power of habit. You can also give us a call, 206-543-5869, 800-289-5869, or write to us, conversation@KUOW.org.
Now don't have me break this thing down for nothing. Now I'm going to see y'all on y'all baddest behavior. Lend me some sugar. I am your neighbor. Here we go. Oh, shake it, shake it, shake it. Shake it, 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 shake it